The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Protests have rocked Colombia recently. Congress's Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission held a hearing on July 1st to examine the causes. On this edition of Century of Lies, we're going to hear from a couple of the witnesses. Elizabeth Dickinson is a senior analyst for Colombia with the International Crisis Group.
International Crisis Group is a global organization committed to prevention, mitigation, and resolution of deadly conflict. And I hope to speak to you today in the context and spirit of that mission. Colombia today is locked in its worst bout of unrest in recent memory. Peaceful protests have erupted in all of Colombia's departments, rural and urban, involving a broad array of social actors. The government's response has leaned heavily on the security forces, and Bogota's wavering and belated commitment to negotiations has inflamed tensions. Our primary message for you today is this: the simmering crisis in Colombia could jeopardize the country's chance at consolidating a fragile and incomplete peace following the signing of a 2016 peace accord with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. Unless decisive action is taken to address the inequality, lack of opportunity, and police brutality that has brought Colombians to the street, demonstrations will likely continue to erupt, creating further instability and with it, grave risks. Police brutality could escalate conflict and further erode the force's credibility and effectiveness. Right-wing vigilante violence against demonstrators could grow more lethal and organized. Turmoil could generate more opportunities for armed and criminal groups to consolidate their control, above all in rural areas long affected by conflict. These high stakes are exactly why the United States, which has invested so much in Colombia's stability, should take a greater role in calming tensions. I speak to you having spent the last 2 months traveling throughout Colombia, including to the city of Cali on the Pacific coast, the center of protests, Guaviare in the Amazon region, Catatumbo along the Venezuelan border, and of course, Bogota, where I reside. And my comments are based on this field research, as well as dozens of conversations with local and national government officials, military personnel, civil society, and religious figures. Crisis Group will also detail our full conclusions in a report, which we will publish tomorrow and which I recommend to you. I want to first address the protests, why they're happening, then discuss risks of escalation, and finally ways that we believe the United States could help. Colombia's protests reflect, in the words of one protester, decades of accumulated injustice. They began over a controversial tax reform, but have since extended to reflect deep socioeconomic grievances and anger at the security forces. At their peak in May, protests were happening nationwide daily. Protesters also erected a series of roadblocks within cities and between cities to draw attention to their cause. According to polls, 84% of young people in Colombia and 75% of all Colombians view the demonstrations favorably, although roadblocks, almost all of which have now been lifted, were less popular because of their economic impact. Two benchmarks are vital to understanding why these protests are happening now. The first is they're happening after a year of worsening pandemic. The second, 5 years after the signing of Colombia's peace accord with the FARC. During five decades of that armed conflict, the country's main political parties pushed aside fundamental questions about inequality in deference to the scale of the threats that were facing the Colombian state. Since the 2016 peace accord, however, those constraints are no longer in place, while long-standing rifts in Colombian society have grown more pronounced. Colombia is deeply unequal, as the chairman mentioned, and elites tend to be entrenched and protective of their benefits. A year of on and off lockdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic served to intensify this experience of marginalization, with the poor and urban poor particularly hit hardest by restrictions on mobility. In impoverished rural areas, promised a sweeping transformation in the 2016 peace accord. Protesters say that they've been left waiting for promised government support, even as armed groups expanding in the territory have made their livelihoods and physical safety more precarious. The government was late to understand and acknowledge the extent of discontent. It has struggled to express empathy and has described protesters instead as troublemakers, vandals, and urban terrorists. Together with documented police violence, these reactions have added to the added flames to the fire at times. Although the number of protests declined in June, we should not be lulled into believing that this crisis is over. Political forces on all sides may be tempted to let the tension simmer heading into 2022 presidential elections here in Colombia in order to appeal to their bases. But there are at least three serious risks to doing so. First, continued police brutality that escalates conflictivity and erodes the force's credibility. In addition to the direct harm that is done to civilians, police abuse undermines the force's ability to control crime and protect communities. Second, right-wing opposition to protests could erupt into further vigilante violence. Armed groups of armed civilians have on several occasions fired directly upon protesters without the police intervening to stop them. A deep history in Colombia of right-wing paramilitary activity raises concerns that these groups could grow and increasingly use brazen violence against left-wing activists. Third and finally, armed and criminal groups could dig in. Let me be clear. Illegal armed and criminal groups neither organize the protests, nor are they the driving force behind participation. And here I want to highlight our research and ground presence throughout Colombia, that the evidence simply does not point to this fact. But they may be the ultimate beneficiaries of prolonged unrest. In urban areas, roadblocks have cordoned off whole parts of cities such as Cali, creating gray zones over which the state had limited control. In rural areas, armed groups leveraged mobilizations, manipulated them, and used the opportunity to impose new taxes, intimidate residents, and by some accounts, expand trafficking activity. Meanwhile, the unpopularity of the government's response breathed new oxygen into these groups' political rhetoric, and their entrenchment may well be long-lasting. In this alarming context, we suggest the United States could consider some of the following steps. First, express and offer support for comprehensive police reform. Colombia's police were built as a counterinsurgency force in a different era, and they are ill-prepared for the challenge of facing unarmed protesters. While President Iván Duque's proposal for reform is a welcome step in the right direction, it falls short in ways that I am happy to discuss. Second, the U.S. should communicate the importance of a negotiated solution with demonstrators. Crucially, Bogota needs to hold national-level talks and commit to participating in local negotiations at a decision-making level. Third and finally, the U.S. should continue to support the complete implementation of the 2016 Peace Accord, which provides a roadmap to address rural grievances. Ultimately, peace will depend upon the long-term process of opening up economic opportunities to marginalized citizens.
That was Elizabeth Dickinson, a senior analyst for Colombia with the International Crisis Group. She was testifying before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission on the protests in Colombia. Angela Maria Penagos is the director of the Agri-Food Initiative at the University of the Andes.
Both the pandemic and the recent protests have revealed concerns about food security and the pattern of rural development in Colombia. Colombia is a country with enormous differences between people and between regions, such that certain areas, especially the periphery and rural areas, present very unfavorable conditions for their population. Therefore, it cannot be said that opportunities and development are balanced between rural and urban areas and regions. That should be one of the biggest concerns if we want really to advance in peace and reactivation. Additionally, it is crucial to recognize that the rural areas have traditionally been the scenario of many of the most significant problems that the country has faced throughout its republican history. High levels of concentration and informality in land ownership, poverty, armed conflict, natural disaster, dispossession, displacement, and an evident lack in the growth of the agricultural sector, which contributes to deepening these problems. Awareness about the situation of rural areas has increased in recent years. However, this has not been accompanied by a tangible advancements in the implementation of policies that put rural areas on a path to prosperity. Despite the fact that the majority of Colombians' economic activities is concentrated in urban areas and that urban development has become a lead driver for growth, as a society, Colombia maintains important rural characteristics. 56% of the population live in towns with fewer than 1 million inhabitants that have strong interrelation with economic, social, and cultural rural activities. Indeed, according to the Mission for the Rural Transformation, about 31% of the population still live in rural or dispersed rural municipalities, and of the total population living in rural areas, almost 85% identify themselves as campesinos or small farmers. So it is important to remember that Colombia's great progress in reducing poverty in the past 20 years has been highly unequal, and differences are very telling in rural areas, where the government has not been able to provide basic goods and services. This has affected the most critical, isolated, and disconnected areas, which are strongly correlated with the places where there is significant armed confrontation and illegal economic activities such as coca cultivation and some mining activities. A study done by RIMES found that dispersed rural municipalities are 2.8 times more likely to experience conditions of poverty than predominantly urban municipalities. Furthermore, according to the multidimensional poverty index, 35% of rural households are poor, compared to 12% for urban ones in 2019, and in 2020, almost 43% of the rural population was in monetary poverty. Unquestionably, the rural population, and in particular women, indigenous people, Afro-descendant communities, and young people have been perhaps the most affected. This group face multiple limitations, which keep them vulnerable and constrain their opportunities and the exercise of their human rights. That is to say, they suffer the consequences of the armed conflict, environmental degradation, neglect of rural areas, and historical discrimination. In addition, rural areas present significant deficiencies in those achievements related to civil rights. 20% of rural households experience illiteracy, while urban areas, the figure is 6%. In addition, 41% of rural households do not have access to an improved water source, and 90% have informal working conditions. The pandemic effects reveal that although we didn't face a serious problem with food supply, we met limitations in the distribution process due to a highly concentrated food distribution system, which can cause restrictions to food access, especially for poor people when faced with shocks like lockdowns and blockades. Many of the small and medium-sized cities, such as Mocoa, Leticia, San Jose del Guaviare, are not well connected with other places and depend on a centralized distribution system for essential necessity in food and fuel. For example, Huila and Nariño rural households experience 50% borderline food insecurity. This condition affected more women than men. However, during this period, the small and medium food commercialization circuits have come into play. Therefore, there could be an opportunity for small farmers to link to inclusive food distribution channels that would give them more resilience to handle shocks and vulnerabilities. Moreover, that could be an actual window of opportunity for many small and medium cities with relation with rural zones. In this context, and recognizing the deep inequalities that Colombia experienced between rural and urban zones, public policy has presented an urban bias, not only from the distribution economic public resources, but also in terms of design and intervention of policy instruments. The responsibility to ensure better conditions for development and offer opportunities to rural inhabitants has been centered in the Ministry of Agriculture. The other ministries have generally not adopted enough approaches or instruments that address the problem of the rural sector. That is what it is necessary, and I take advantage of this opportunity to highlight the need to address this problem from different scenarios, including the international cooperation. Otherwise, it will be complicated for Colombia to move forward and transform itself into a more inclusive country from a rights perspective. Thank you very much.
That was Angela Maria Penagos, director of the Agri-Food Initiative at the University of the Andes. She was testifying before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission on the protests in Colombia. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Jose Miguel Vivanco is the director of the Americas Division at Human Rights Watch.
This hearing is timely and important. Human Rights Watch is more concerned about the current situation in Colombia than it had been in several years. Since April 28, tens of thousands of Colombians have taken to the streets to protest about a range of issues, including economic inequality, police violence, unemployment, and poor public services. According to Carlos Ruiz Massieu, the head of the UN in Colombia and representative of Secretary General Guterres, there is no evidence whatsoever of foreign intervention in the protest in Colombia. A team of Human Rights Watch researchers have been following the situation closely. We have conducted more than 170 interviews with people in 26 cities across Colombia, obtained extensive information from Colombian authorities, and reviewed a wide range of sources, including necropsy reports and independent evaluations by international forensic experts. We concluded that the Colombian police officers have repeatedly dispersed peaceful demonstrations and used excessive and often brutal force, including firing live ammunition. I personally presented these findings to President Iván Duque on June 9. We have gathered first-hand evidence indicating that the police have killed at least 25 protesters or bystanders and engaged in multiple cases of beating, brutal beating, sexual abuse, as well as hundreds of arbitrary detentions. The police killed at least 18 protesters or bystanders with live ammunition. The vast majority of them had injuries in vital organs, such as the thorax and head, which are consistent with the practice of shooting to kill. Armed people in civilian clothes have also attacked protesters, killing at least 5 of them. The police have times failed to take action or to prevent or stop these civilians' attacks. Over 1,100 protesters and bystanders have been injured since April 28. Some have suffered permanent loss of vision in one eye, apparently due to the impact of tear gas cartridges or kinetic impact projectiles. While most demonstrations were peaceful, some individuals engaged in serious acts of violence, including attacking police officers. Hundreds of police officers have been injured, over 190 of them severely, and 3 have died. Some protesters blocked roads for prolonged periods, at times impeding the distribution of food or the circulation of ambulances. Fortunately, these roads blockings have dramatically decreased in recent weeks. Violence against police officers and road blocking that impedes access to food or health services are unjustifiable, but they are not excuse for police brutality. The Colombian police have already engaged in serious abuses against protesters in 2019 and 2020. These abuses are not isolated incidents by rogue officers, but rather the result of systemic shortcomings of the Colombian police. The police is, unlike in any other country in Latin America, under the authority of the Defense Ministry of Colombia, and has been deployed to fight armed groups alongside the armed forces in a manner that has often blurred their distinct functions. Additionally, the police disciplinary system lacks independence, and officers implicated in abuses are also often tried in military courts where there is little chance of accountability and almost zero transparency. President Duque announced that his government will take steps to transform the police. Some of these initiatives, such as a proposed reform to the police disciplinary system, could have a positive impact on police abuses if properly designed and obviously implemented. But overall, the changes announced by President Duque fall short. Critically, this failed to transfer the police to the Ministry of Interior and don't limit the military justice system ability to handle investigation into police abuses. President Duque has also acknowledged that the police committed some abuses and said the officers involved in those abuses would be punished. He says his government has a zero tolerance policy toward those abuses, but these commitments cannot be taken at face value, unfortunately. So far, Colombian authorities have failed to achieve meaningful progress in prosecuting officers involved in the police abuses committed against protesters in 2019 and 2020. No officer has been criminally convicted in these cases so far.
That was José Miguel Vivanco, director of the Americas Division at Human Rights Watch. He testified on July 1st at a hearing before the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission on the protests in Colombia. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're going to stay with Colombia. The International Drug Policy Consortium held a side event at the 47th session of the UN's Human Rights Council entitled Strengthening the Role of the UN Human Rights System in Drug Policies, the Case of Arbitrary Detention. Let's hear from one of the speakers. Claudia Cardona is a psychologist with Corporación Humanas in Colombia.
Buenos días y buenas tardes.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, good morning to all of you. Thank you for being here. Thank you very much for the organizers for inviting me to be part of this panel today. Very moving for me. I never thought that I would be able to access such influential and important spaces, having been someone who was in prison. So this report is extremely important. It's extremely significant because we see how drug policies have a disproportionate impact on women, especially women who come from vulnerable situations or vulnerable communities. Furthermore, it makes a number of very important recommendations. For example, the recommendation that the punishment for drug-related offenses needs to be proportional to the offense in question. It also urges all member states and all countries to work together to implement these recommendations. So in Colombia, as in many countries in this region, the majority of women who are incarcerated are there for drug-related offenses. According to the report, IMPEC, which is the organization in charge of prisons in Colombia, at the end of May 2021, there were 680,000 women currently incarcerated in Colombia. And almost half of them were there for drug-related offenses. And 96.8% of these women are there without a firm sentence. And this amount of women, this large population of women who are incarcerated, is as a result of the war on drugs, which disproportionately affects women from poor communities. Many times women need to, are in a very difficult situation. They need to provide for their families and they end up turning to different means to provide for their families. And so here we see that there's also a very strong element of gender and sexism. It's related to gender. It's not at all irrelevant. In Colombia, the Constitutional Court has found that there have been many violations of human rights within the penal system in Colombia. And this has been said, but nothing has actually changed. My friends, my colleagues, who I know from prison, are living under extremely horrific conditions, which includes a lack of access to proper food, there's lack of access to healthcare and lack of access to reproductive rights, especially. These poor conditions made the situation of COVID in these prisons worse. There were many, many women who died because they were not able to access appropriate healthcare. So we can see how being in prison actually is dangerous for one's health. And this is something that we see in the reports. Since the pandemic began, IMPEC created a, they investigated these issues, but they didn't actually manage to achieve what they set out to do. What they actually did when it came to responding to the pandemic was they made everything worse, and they made it so that women were even more deprived of their rights. For example, one of the steps that the Colombian government took was to stop allowing people to come in. This meant that lawyers couldn't come in, attorneys couldn't come in, which limited women's access to legal counsel and legal advice. Family members were also prohibited from coming in. And instead of actually helping to prevent the spread of the pandemic, what it did was really negatively impact women psychologically, because they were there for many months and even over a year without being able to see their family. Finally, by barring external health professionals from coming in, women were deprived of their rights to health. Psychiatric professionals weren't able to come in and provide mental health support or psychological services. Other people who were barred from entering prisons included representatives from human rights organizations, which made it even more difficult to properly monitor the in person and on the ground conditions that women are facing in prison. In addition to barring people from coming in, many health products and other products were also not able to be brought into prisons. This included, for example, sanitary products and menstrual products for women, and other necessary sanitary and health products. It was also found that prisoners were not being provided with appropriate food, and that followed the standards. Thirdly, I would like to say that the pandemic has been a missed opportunity to really assess the situation within prisons and to improve these conditions.
That was Claudia Cardona. She's with Corporación Humanas in Colombia. She was speaking at a side event organized by the International Drug Policy Consortium at the 47th session of the UN's Human Rights Council, entitled Strengthening the Role of the UN Human Rights System in Drug Policies, The Case of Arbitrary Detention. And for now, folks, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century, along with an archive of past shows, at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. There's a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.